It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We discuss the surge in manufacturing jobs in America and what it means for Rust Belt states like Wisconsin. Join in by calling with your questions on the future of domestic manufacturing in America, in your city, in your town, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jim Tankersley covers economic and tax policy for the New York Times. Jim, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, put this in perspective for us. How much of a boom is our nation experiencing in manufacturing?
Yeah, we're going through something that's really unusual in a good way for us after a recession. So usually after a recession or in the midst of a recession, manufacturing lays off more workers than other parts of the economy. And then after the recession, it's slower to bring those jobs back. And neither of those things is true this time. In the sort of the wake of the pandemic recession, manufacturing wasn't as big of a job loser as it normally is during that recession. And it's more than made back all the jobs it's lost, during the trough of the recession, which is the first time since the 1970s that we've actually gotten back, you know, post-recession to the level that we were before the recession, which is a big deal.
Can you do a little bit of comparing, contrasting? I mean, what was the boom fueled by in the 70s versus what is causing it today?
Yeah. So in the 70s, traditional manufacturing, across the country was the big boom. Obviously, in the first post-World War II era, you had a lot of steel and cars, and those were the big drivers, up through the 70s when we would lose jobs and then they would come back in factories. But today it's different. It's not those big brawny kind of the types of things that President Biden or former President Trump like to celebrate, you know, sitting behind the wheel of a Hummer in Detroit kind of manufacturing.
I can visualize that. So carry on.
Right. Yeah. No, I went to Detroit with the president to watch him zoom around in a Hummer. It was great. While automakers are doing okay coming out of this recession, it is ice cream manufacturing and pharmaceuticals and breweries, which actually count as manufacturing. And so it's sort of a different wave of factory jobs that is leading this renaissance.
It sounds like a real true diversification of jobs. I mean, what kind of jobs are being created in this boom?
I mean, they're good jobs. Manufacturing still has, depending on how you look at it, kind of a wage premium over other jobs in the economy. They tend to be good jobs that increasingly require some training, some technological competence, some skill. These are not just walk in off the street and pull a lever kind of manufacturing jobs. And manufacturing jobs have always been very physically taxing and difficult, and that's why they've paid better. But I think what we see now, and I think which a really interesting part of this story is, so much of the new manufacturing job creation is being aided by computers and other technology, and it's that technological advancement that has allowed the production to stay in the United States as opposed to going abroad, you know, with the outsourcing booms that we saw in the 90s and especially in the early 2000s. So these are jobs that are good jobs for blue collar workers, but do require that sort of technological skill a lot in order to make them go.
We're talking about the rebirth, if you will, of manufacturing in the U.S. What to make of it? We have New York Times journalist Jim Tankersley, who follows these economic trends. And you can join in on manufacturing, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jim, where in the country are new manufacturing jobs being created? Do you see any hotspots?
Yeah, they're all over, which is the good news. But the hotspots are not necessarily where you'd think either. The Mountain West is probably the biggest one, and if you think about it, it's like, oh, well, we've added a lot of Tesla jobs in Nevada. We've added, President Biden is going today to Arizona to talk about, they aren't even here yet, but coming semiconductor jobs that are being added in Arizona. There's a lot of that across the Mountain West, and actually Florida has added a decent number of manufacturing jobs as well. Traditional industrial Midwestern states like Wisconsin have added back jobs, but not at that same pace that the Mountain West and the Southeast have.
Why might that be?
I don't know, actually. I think part of it is just the composition of what we're looking at. I mean, part of this is also, and I hate to say this because it sounds like such an economics reporter kind of way to get out of a question, but like we have a pretty small sample size. This recovery has actually not been going on very long compared to previous recoveries from recessions. It was obviously just a very different recession. We turned the lights off on the economy and then tried to turn them right back on, and with mixed results. I think there's a good chance that we will see more of a pickup. I know, you know, the one really interesting part of this is that Congress is doing a lot to try to encourage more manufacturing jobs with investments in semiconductors and other things. And a lot of those investments are explicitly targeting places that are former industrial powerhouses. I was out in Ohio with some administration officials earlier this year, kind of talking about what that looks like in Ohio. And, you know, I think this the same is going to be true of the rest of the industrial Midwest, where there's going to be more of a concerted effort to revitalize kind of past great manufacturing centers. All of that said, there's lots of reasons why jobs migrate. And one of them is just that, you know, different places specialize in different things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for something as simple
in regions,
yes,
like you Automotive Alley, when you mentioned Detroit, that made me think about the cluster from Detroit down through, you know, Alabama, or the geographic clustering in manufacturing. I mean, do you still see that as a strong strategy?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that certainly the administration is betting on clusters right now into leading very innovative growth across the country, across these places. But you know, how do you bet on breweries, right? Like if they're a big.
Oh, we bet in Wisconsin.
I mean, I personally bet on them all the time. I'm from Oregon. I'm a huge microbrew fan, so I understand. But you know, that's consumer preference, and that's mm-hmm. I guess the last part of this that we haven't talked about really quickly is a huge part of what's going on is that Americans are just buying more manufactured goods, and that's helping. You know, during the pandemic, we bought more sofas and we spent less at restaurants, and we're slow to regain our old habits, and that has helped factory jobs across the country.
We haven't touched on right-to-work laws or the impact of unions in this environment. I mean, we've seen the large rejection of unions over the past few decades. And of course, in, you know, a bit of an uptick here as workers organizing in the pandemic. But how do unions factor into this economic storyline, or whether right-to-work states like Wisconsin, you know, are being impacted by these manufacturing jobs popping up?
It's a great question. And some of these manufacturing jobs are unionized, and many of them aren't. And, you know, often that is geographical. So a lot of the jobs in the Southeast are not going to be union jobs, just because that is the sort of history of those states and their workforce. And the UAW has had, for example, less success in unionizing auto plants in the South than in the industrial Midwest. So yeah, I think it's when you're a company figuring out where you want to put an investment, what you think your labor costs are going to be, which tend to be higher with a unionized workforce in ways that are good for workers, is going to be one of the things you're considering. But you're also considering, you know, what are the supply chains like? What are the resources like? What is the supply of workers like in a region? And it's never just as simple as, yeah, it's unionized or it's not.
The New York Times' Jim Tankersley with us reporting on why U.S. factory jobs are booming, makes comparisons to decades past. Join in on what you're experiencing at your plant, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here as we discuss the push to onshore manufacturing, boosting R&D to make more semiconductor chips here in America versus Asia. We'll talk more about that. Join in on the future of manufacturing, especially here in the Midwest, 800-642-1234. Jim Tankersley covers economic policy at the New York Times and stays with us. Jim, what policies have you seen state governments doing or enacting that have a track record of creating manufacturing jobs?
That is a great question. And I actually, long ago and far away, was a reporter in Toledo, Ohio, and looked at just this thing, because Ohio was trying to figure out how to boost its manufacturing sector again. And there was a great long-term study from the Cleveland Federal Reserve Bank that looked at just this question: what do states do to grow better than others? And the short answer was, like, not a lot of the things you might think: tax incentives, other things. It was really investing in two things: education. Having an educated workforce really helps state economies compared to other economies over time, especially with advanced industries like we're talking about right now in manufacturing, and patent production. So being able to churn out marketable new ideas, often from universities. And I think actually, if we look at what the what Congress and the Biden administration are trying to do right now to encourage more manufacturing production, they both play right into those strategies. It's the idea of they want to site advanced manufacturing centers like Micron in upstate New York, for example, that just announced $100 billion in places that have a skilled workforce and a track record of innovative manufacturing. And so I think if you're a state like Wisconsin, like Pennsylvania, like Ohio, and you're trying to boost these things, that's one of the crucial backbone things you can do is invest in education, invest in innovation, and look for ways to turn good ideas into marketable, you know, new industries.
Okay, let's bring on a call now. Christine in Eau Claire. Christine, hi, what would you like to bring up?
Well, a couple of things, if that's all right. Good morning. I was just listening to what you were talking about in terms of investing in education, and I just find it curious that at one time Wisconsin had a world-renowned UW system, and then when the Koch brothers' puppet Scott Walker came into power in 2010, $250 million was gutted from the University of Wisconsin. And I just find it really frustrating that the federal government won't raise the minimum wage. And I know we can applaud the billion-dollar, I don't know what they are, whatever chip manufacturing we're currently doing in the U.S., but the fact of the matter is we, as a country, we've divested from the middle class, and any time we talk about investment, it's not multinational corporations. You know, they're not the ones investing as a whole. Somehow tax incentives or, you know, infrastructure, the public always has to pay a price. So it seems to me that over my lifetime, the social contract has been broken and multinational corporations have gutted Main Street, have privatized their profits and socialized the costs.
Christine, thank you. Jim, you know, Christine, you know, bringing up multiple issues here. What do you make of her analysis?
Well, I actually wrote a book about the sort of the hollowing out of the American middle class, which I appreciate Christine giving me a chance to plug very quickly. It's called The Riches of This Land, but it's basically just about this, the divestment from people in the United States that is hollowed out the middle class. I don't agree with Christine on every point here, but the basic story of we need to be investing more in public goods like humans, like education and people, is I think very well supported by the evidence of what's happened in America over the last half century. And sort of, you know, we built a great middle class, but by investing in our people, particularly in women, particularly in people of color. And then we have sort of gone away from those investments, and that has hurt us in our quest to keep the world's greatest middle class.
You mentioned earlier President Biden heading to Arizona today to you know, show off investments in semiconductor manufacturing through the CHIPS Act. Is this act boosting domestic production, or is it too early to tell?
It's too early to tell, like, truly empirically how much it's going to boost it. But there, if you just judge it by the rash of announcements that have come right after the law was passed, it sure looks like it's doing something positive. You know, again, this Micron announcement in upstate New York, $100 billion investment. the CEO of Micron stood up on the stage and said, we would not be doing this if not for the CHIPS Act. Hmm. I think that's true of what the president's seeing in Arizona. There's a bunch of others. There's one in Ohio. Like there's been a lot of announcements thus far, and it's sort of early days to see. Congress hasn't even funded the full CHIPS Act yet. And I would also like to point out, this is a bipartisan effort. There are 17 Republicans in the Senate voted for it. This is industrial policy to boost manufacturing is one of the very few things that large swaths of both parties seem to agree on right now. And that's a big change from even 10 years ago.
Is manufacturing these semiconductors, is that a complicated process to get started here, whether it's skilled workers or the inputs, the raw materials?
Yeah, it is. And I mean, we have some semiconductor manufacturing in the United States. We just don't have nearly as much as we'd like to have. So building it out to scale, everyone who I talk to about this, who is in the industry or around it, keeps telling me is it's going to take time. It's going to take a lot of time and a lot of money to build this out. But we have the know-how, at least, to do it. It's just a matter of scaling it up kind of dramatically. And then obviously pushing the boundaries, because the most lucrative manufacturing is going to always be at the frontiers of new things that nobody else can do anywhere else. And that is the real hope here, is that the United States will be the leader in super advanced chip manufacturing.
Talking about manufacturing in the U.S. with New York Times reporter Jim Tankersley, you can join in on manufacturing. What's happening in your plant? 800-642-1234. I found it interesting through your reporting as well, the CHIPS Act isn't just about semiconductor building. It's also doing, you know, R&D and doing more in various manufacturing industries and these innovation hubs in the works. Can you tell us more about what this act is doing beyond the semiconductors?
Yeah, actually, I wrote about this just today. The bill creates a system of 20 kind of pilot project innovation hubs, they're called. And they basically have two goals. And it spends $10 billion on them, but Congress needs to actually appropriate that money. The goals of the hubs are, first off, to do just the sort of innovation work we've been talking about, to take scientific research and help convert it into stuff that you can sell and make industries around. So they will be... The hubs will be centered near universities, and the idea is that they'll be able to kind of help commercialize research better. But the second thing is explicitly a bet on revitalizing struggling economies, places that have been left behind, formerly great industrial centers. And so if Congress funds them and the Commerce Department starts a site selection process, we might see in the next couple of years the creation of these hubs in some places like Toledo, Ohio, or Provo, Utah, or sort of a wide range of, you know, interesting university type towns that have varied industrial histories. And the hope is that will create new centers, new sort of like mini manufacturing boomlets across the country that could then sprout into something really big, like the auto corridor or whatever.
So outside your typical San Francisco's and New York and Boston, getting into smaller cities that do have some type of tech hub that is going on right now, perhaps a university setting.
Yeah, and the hope here is, I mean, there's a lot of economic activity in the United States that it's concentrated in Chicago, LA, New York, Silicon Valley, those superstar cities. And the idea is that we're wasting a lot of the economic potential of the country by not investing more in those other areas, places like Wisconsin. And I think that it's empirically true. You see lots of good evidence for many, you know, geographic regions that used to produce at a much higher level have struggled with the outsourcing and automation trends of the last 20 or 40 years. And so if there's a way to revitalize them, to bet on them, to spend more money on them and turn them back into really big engines of growth, that's going to be great for the entire economy. It'll help New York if you help Wisconsin.
In our last moments together here, we haven't talked about robots and automation, manufacturing increasingly using that type of technology. When you see these boom in jobs, what about the robotic aspects of them and that can be done by robots instead of humans?
Well, I think we'll see a lot more of it. And so that's the first thing, is that the more advanced manufacturing gets, the more automated it's going to be. But we also see that there just aren't enough humans right now who are able to work in the open jobs that we have. The number has fallen a little bit in the last couple of months, but there are still something like 750,000 open manufacturing jobs that, that manufacturers can't fill across the country. So we are both at a moment where robots and computers are doing more and more things in manufacturing that humans used to do. And also in a moment where we still don't have enough humans who are willing and able and trained to take these jobs in manufacturing that need humans. So it's a fascinating time to be working in or covering the industry.
Jim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jim Tankersley covers economic and tax policy for the New York Times. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the debt owed by local governments between 2000 and 2020 and how record debt affects our cities and towns, villages. Join our conversation about borrowing and call with your questions about local debt, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jason Stein is here, Research Director of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Jason, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
So the Forum's new report shows that cities, towns, and villages across Wisconsin are facing record levels of debt. Give us a sense of the magnitude first, and I mean, put a number on it.
Well, so if you look at all city and county governments in Wisconsin, you know, cities, villages, and towns, you see in 2020, at the close of the year, more than $11 billion in debt, which was a pretty substantial increase over the prior year. And that was the most we've seen in records going back 20 years, even after you adjust for inflation.
Why are local governments taking on more debt, especially now?
Sure. I think it's a variety of reasons. I mean, at the time, the data is always two years old on this topic. But at that time, interest rates were very low. You have seen as well, I think, a need to replace infrastructure at the local level, you know, to do other capital projects like IT projects. And then, you know, there are some of the financial challenges that local governments have had over the past 10 years in Wisconsin, as well as the fact that, and we can talk about it, it's a little bit complicated, but there's a real incentive in state law in some ways for local governments to do certain things with debt these days that they might have done using cash in the past.
Doing certain things with debt, you mean in terms of providing services that they would have in the past relied on taxpayer dollars? What do you mean by that?
Sure. So the first thing to understand is that in Wisconsin, local governments have something called levy limits on their property taxes. And those limits basically say that you can't raise your property taxes that you use for your day-to-day operating budget by more than the percentage of net new construction in your community. And, you know, like last year, that average percentage across the state was 1.7%, which is, you know, well below the rate of inflation. So, but if you borrow money, you can raise property taxes as a local government by as much as you need to make your debt payments. So if there's something that in the past, let's say, buying police cars or, you know, putting trees in the right of way between the sidewalk and the street, you might use as a local government, as a mayor, a city council, you might use debt to do those things now, where once you would have done them in cash, because you know that you can increase your property tax under state law to make that debt payment. So it's a kind of incentive to go the route of debt rather than cash.
Did the level of borrowing that you saw over the decades surprise you at all?
I mean, that's a good question. You know, to some degree, we've been tracking this in various ways. So, I mean, to some degree, we thought that it would be the case that debt had gone up so much, and that's why we did the work of running the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think one thing that is interesting that we had not seen previously is just in the last 5 years, you see towns, which are the smallest units of government in Wisconsin, and they traditionally borrow money or they use much less debt per capita than like a large city would. But you are seeing now towns over the past 5 years, even though they still don't carry a lot of debt in an absolute sense, their debt is growing more quickly than all other units of local government. So that is one thing that's a little bit of a new trend.
In the midst of this debt, there is interest rates. And it reminds me that yesterday we talked with DOA Secretary Kathy Blumenfeld, Department of Administration, and said that Wisconsin was able to refinance a lot of its debt during, you know, the historically low interest rates, no more, but, you know, saving hundreds of millions of dollars. Have local governments done the same with their debt? Have they refinanced?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, interest rates were very low, especially during the pandemic, and local and state governments did take advantage of that. For instance, you know, I know the city of Milwaukee issued a note of more than $100 million that it kind of uses to ensure that it has strong cash flow. Normally, it would do that. It would kind of issue a note like that every year, and it would sort of be subject to whatever the interest rate was that year. You know, Milwaukee actually went out and did a 10-year note, I think in 2020. And so they were able to lock in very low interest rates, you know, so that now as the interest rates are rising, they are sort of protected from that. So there's definitely been cases over the past few years where local governments have used debt in smart ways. One of the challenges going forward is with interest rates rising, they don't have the same opportunity to do that they did 2 years ago. So that is one of the reasons to watch this issue going forward.
Which might also make the case that not all debt is bad. And if you could flesh that out a bit as well.
Right, absolutely. So, I mean, I think if you think about it just in the context of a family, you know, if a family uses debt to buy a home or they use debt to put their son or daughter through college, I mean, those can be very good investments that are only possible because of borrowing. And it's the same for a local government. I mean, if they use debt to replace a bridge that is absolutely critical to, you know, residents of the community being able to, you know, get to work and other activities, you know, that's crucial for their little local economy to have that bridge functioning and safe. So, yeah, there's all kinds of very valid and rewarding things that you can do with debt. At the same time, you know, local governments have to pay it off. And so, you know, the more money at the local level that goes to making debt payments, you know, at least as a political sense, you know, there may be a reluctance on the part of local leaders to raise taxes to do other things like police or fire or libraries or streets. So, you know, on the one hand, there can be really great benefits to borrowing. On the other hand, you know, there is a cost, and the cost has got to be factored in.
Talking about debt owed by local governments in Wisconsin, Jason Stein with us, Research Director of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. You can join in on local debt, local government debt, what you see in your community, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. There's a line in your report, Wisconsin's tax burden hit its lowest level in two decades in 2020. Can you help us understand this rising level of debt and yet tax burden at its lowest level?
Sure. Well, I mean, that gets back to a number of things that have been done at the state level. More than anything, the state has put pretty substantial limits on local property taxes, both schools and for, you know, municipalities and counties. And those, you know, key part of those are the levy limits that I mentioned
mm-hmm.
earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you look at our overall property tax burden in Wisconsin, it has really fallen substantially. It's still pretty high for homeowners compared to other states, but that has to do with the fact that, you know, we have fewer tax breaks or tax benefits that go to homeowners in Wisconsin than in many other states. But if you just look at the overall taxes paid, property taxes paid by homes and businesses, you know, that burden has been falling and our tax burden has been falling overall in Wisconsin. But again, you know, to some degree, if a local government is having trouble financing things, you know, out of their regular operating budget using cash, you know, that can actually might be an incentive to issue more debt rather than less. So those two things, you know, aren't necessarily in contradiction with one another to say that the tax burden is low, but the debt load is high.
And meanwhile, Wisconsin property values rose more than 13% in 2022. That's a record-setting number. How much do these communities, cities, and villages rely on rising property values to address the debt?
Sure. I'm glad you bring that up, Kate. That's an important thing. It definitely makes it easier for local governments to finance debt if property values are rising because, you know, in Wisconsin, the main local tax is the property tax. And so, you know, you can have a community like Madison that has, on a per capita basis, pretty high debt levels. But because Madison also has very high property values, you know, the debt as a share of overall property value in the city or sort of the city's ability to pay remains pretty manageable. And so, you know, when you see that big statewide increase in property values that has just happened, that is definitely something that makes the debt load a little bit easier to carry at the local level. You know, the flip side is that now as interest rates are rising, you know, we're seeing a big slowdown in the you know, real estate market. So you may not see going forward, you may not see that same level of growth. In fact, you probably won't.
Let's bring on a call now. Jeff in Delafield. Jeff, hi. What would you like to raise?
Yes, good morning. My concern is, you know, first of all, as a taxpayer, I'm certainly appreciative of revenue limits and caps and all those sorts of things. And I'm certainly leery of debt. But what I see are municipalities relying on development, which is really their only other alternative. But that has its own problems in that, you know, it's changing the complexion of our smaller towns, increased traffic, noise, pollution, everything that goes along with it, environmental issues, runoff, and so forth. But I don't know what the answer is, but I don't like to see all this rampant development that seems to be the go-to tool for many municipalities in the light of the issues that you're talking about. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Changing the look and feel of these communities through the new construction, the industrial parks, the strip malls, the new apartments and things like that. What do you make of that push-pull, Jason?
Well, at the local level, you know, to increase their budget, there's at least to increase their property tax, there's really only two things that local governments are allowed to do under state law. One is to green light development, like new homes or businesses or apartment buildings, or B, to go to referendum and ask voters to allow them to raise the property taxes. You know, there are some limited exceptions in state law, you know, like the debt exemption that I mentioned, but there really are not many. So those are the two main things. You know, so I think it's going to make it hard for local governments to turn down development. Hmm. You know, I mean, that said, in the state, we do not have enough housing to meet, you know, in many communities to meet workforce needs. So, you know, to some degree, having an incentive for housing at least to be approved can be a good thing when you think about, you know, the housing challenges that many communities have.
Wisconsin Policy Forum Research Director Jason Stein with us to explore the growing debts of local governments in our state, what the trend could mean for our finances. Join in with your questions about municipal debt, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A recent report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum shows Wisconsin's cities, towns, and villages are facing record levels of debt over two decades. And we dig into the report with Jason Stein, who is the research director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Be part of this with your questions about municipal debt, what you see in your area, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. And Jason Stein stays with us. Jason, let's talk more about services. How could larger debt loads affect local government services like police and firefighters, parks and libraries?
Sure. I mean, at least as a practical matter, there's a limit to how much property taxes a local mayor and city council are going to levy, you know, both politically and practically. And so when you think about that, their budget is not unlimited. At a certain point, the community is going to want that budget to stop growing. And so, you know, the bigger portion of that budget that goes to paying off past debt, then the less is going to be available for present day services. And, you know, those are going to, again, be things like public safety, which is almost entirely done at the local level in Wisconsin, local streets, libraries, all those types of local services. You know, they need annual funding. They need, you know, operating funding. And if you're making payments on debt from the past, then you don't have that money available for that.
How can municipal leaders reduce the debt load or stop expanding debt?
I mean, it's a great question. It's not easy. I mean, again, to some degree, debt is not good or bad. It's just a tool, and it really matters more what the tool is used for. So I think maybe the first thing to think about is, you know, in a community, it's not even necessarily how much debt is being issued, but what is it being issued for, mm-hmm. and what is the return? So in other words, you know, if a community needs to issue debt to have safe drinking water, there's really no getting around that, right? I mean, they have to have safe drinking water, so they're going to have to issue, you know, the debt that they need to do to achieve that. But at the same time, there may be other things that they use debt for, whether it's, you know, replacing, you know, or expanding a library or something like that, that may be, you know, it may not be a must do. And then the community can have a discussion about, is this the right time? Is this the right level? You know, could we achieve our goals by doing something smaller? I mean, I think those are the discussions that are most productive for local community leaders to have.
I wonder if you can name names here. I mean, are there communities, debt practices, anyone that stands out as unusual or noteworthy compared to other municipalities across the state?
Well, I'll mention the case of Milwaukee because I think it's a good way of thinking about debt. Milwaukee has had a pretty substantial increase in debt over the past 5-10 years. And in Milwaukee, that is particularly troublesome or challenging because the city also has really substantial unfunded pension liabilities and liabilities for retiree healthcare for retired city workers. And so, you know, you can't also look at the debt in isolation. Mm-hmm. It's what other liabilities does a community have? I mentioned Madison earlier has a pretty high debt load per capita, but it has high property values and it doesn't have a lot of other unfunded liabilities like pension or retiree healthcare debt. So the city of Madison is in a better position to manage the debt that it does have than, say, the city of Milwaukee, which has lower per capita debt levels in Madison, but has some of those other challenges.
And meanwhile, Milwaukee County is still pushing the legislature to, you know, get through a 1% sales tax. You know, that's something that they've really tried to get the legislature to move on. You know, if that would go through, what could that mean for that county and others needing to raise revenue?
So, you know, anything that a community did to either raise revenue or to lower spending on other items is going to make it easier to pay off their debt.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, any other spending cuts or revenue increases that a city like Milwaukee would do, you know, including raising the sales tax, would give it more revenue every year to be able to do all its needs, including pay off its debt. So that is certainly something that could help them manage their debt.
Jason Stein, Research Director of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, as we look at the debt loads of local governments, what it means in communities around Wisconsin, join in 800-642-1234. I mean, Jason, we've gone all the way through this conversation. We haven't even mentioned shared revenue, and we've heard from so many municipalities that shared revenue from the state hasn't kept up with the costs and limits on raising property taxes. So, you know, as Wisconsin has this massive general fund balance, what is the future of that discussion around shared revenue?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you asked about that. So the state government is absolutely, in terms of its budget, sitting in a really remarkable place today that is unlike anything that I think we've really seen, at least in 20 years, if not a generation. One of the reasons that the state is in this position is it's been very tight about how much money it spends on local governments. So, you know, shared revenue, which is the main form of state aid to local governments in Wisconsin, has been really flat over the past 10 years. There's been some increase in funding for roads from the state to local governments, but shared revenue is really not kept up with inflation. So the state has an opportunity to sort of catch local governments up, at least to some extent, on those payments. And if that were to happen, that would certainly be something else, another tool that local governments could draw on, or resource they could draw on to make their debt payments.
One last thing I want to run by you. The amount of one-time federal aid that we've seen in the pandemic, communities receiving, how could this federal aid, this one-time money, affect borrowing habits or repayment plans?
Well, a lot of, because it is one-time money, yep, a lot of local governments did use it for one-time expenses like capital projects. And so to some degree, it should have offset at least some debt at the local level. There's a federal infrastructure law that was signed by President Biden and approved by Congress that is going to provide more funding for infrastructure at the local level. You know, that may also offset some local borrowing. So, you know, some of that federal assistance in recent years, and we don't yet have the data for all this because there's a lag on the getting mm-hmm. the data at the state level, but that may help as well local governments to get this problem under control.
Jason, thank you for joining us.
Okay, great questions. Thanks very much for having me.
Jason Stein is Research Director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. We have a link to its report called Local Debt on the Rise. It's at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.